Russell in Liberta.
Now, just a minute. This is Fred Silberman. Siebenman. Siebenman. And he's here from Moline at a health conference. And he saw the book, Stories from the Round Barn, in the box pronounced catalog. And ordered it because he recognized the barn. And he's about to tell me how he, probably how you came to the farm, isn't it? Because how you knew Liberta and Russell.
Yeah.
Okay, start in telling about that.
During the war.
Tell me.
Okay. Yeah, during the war, you know, there was a considerable shortage of hired help.
Yes.
For working on farms. All the guys were off in the military. Well, us kids in high school, in the city high school like Moline, we didn't have any ag courses, but we had an athletic director who came from the farm, and he decided that he was going to teach after hours a course on agriculture. So all you guys that want to do this, you need to have summer jobs, you know. Oh, well, summer jobs. And so I took this after school.
Mm-hmm.
And Howard Rogers, who owned a farm out south of Moline, south of the airport, had hired Russell and the family to come down and manage the farm for him at Coal Valley. Mm-hmm. And he had 35 head of brown Swiss, purebred brown Swiss. And he was improving that herd, and he'd bought the farm, and not unlike Grandpa Dogan was working at it to improve the life is more. And he built a brand new barn, and we had this nice herd of brown Swiss cows. We were still breeding cows with bulls back in those days, although periodically you could get a guy to come, inseminator to come down and breed some of the cows. And so I lived out there on the farm for two summers and milked cows.
The Coal Farm, the one in?
Out there in Coal Valley.
Russell was there.
Russell was there, yeah. He was working there.
Uh-huh.
And now, I think he had worked at Grandpa Dogan's farm before that.
Yeah.
And then gone down after he got married.
Mm-hmm.
And so I met Tanny Julius, who was later killed in a gas explosion in a house over in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember the other daughter's name right now.
Susan.
Yeah, Susan. Little Susan. And then he, in my junior year, he moved up to Beloit. Went to mm-hmm. work for your dad.
Yeah.
And they lived in the big house.
Yeah, they took over the big house when
Grandpa moved to town.
Grandma moved to town.
Yeah.
It was getting too much for Grandma.
Yeah, that's kind of what I remembered about this, mm-hmm. that part of the story. But at any rate, so, you know, Fred, if you want to come to work, you know, come on up. Back in those days, we didn't drive anywhere. I got on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And took a bus trip to Beloit.
And you were living in Moline then, or near Moline?
Yeah, we were living in town, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was an engineer for John Deere.
Uh-huh.
And he was a tool designer, so he designed tools to make plows. And so he was all for me going to work, wherever you can, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of those workaholic, work ethic kind of people. Not unlike Grandpa Dolan. And so I did. Off I went. Mm-hmm. You know, between my junior and senior year, and rode up on the bus, standing up all the way because, you know, nobody was driving cars and gas was rationed.
Mm-hmm. And so the buses were full.
They were full. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Full. Stood up all the way. Got off in Beloit. Russell came out and picked me up, and so off to the barn I went. Introduced mm-hmm. me to the herdsman. And away we go. And it's interesting times, I guess.
Would Harlan Whitmore have been the herdsman?
He could have been.
Is that a familiar name to you?
That's a familiar name, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Harlan, you're right. There was a guy there that could really drive horses, too. Man, was he good. He could back up a manure spread with a team of horses. That's a four-wheeled manure spread.
I'm trying to remember who was there in 45. Yeah. Would there have been...
big, husky-looking guy. Good-looking guy. Dark hair, you know. Can't remember what his name was anymore. But he operated a lot of machinery. Basically, the herdsman and I were the only ones that really did much with the cattle.
Uh-huh.
Then there was a guy who was the hog man, and I think his
Leonard
name
Beadle?
Was Howard. Well, he was, I've never met a hog man like that. When the sows were farrowing, mm-hmm. he was down taking each little pig that was born and rubbing it off with straw and finding a nipple for it to get onto. And the sows had totally no problem with him doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes they're a little touchy during that period of time. But anyway.
And that was Howard something, huh?
I think his name was Howard.
Okay, well,
he came from town because when he would drive up the road toward the farm to go to work in the morning, the pigs were, all the sows, brood sows were out along the, in a little drop on the, along the road, and they'd run to the fence because mm-hmm. they heard him coming. You know, and
he was their friend.
Well, he was like their pets. Mm-hmm. You know, they were like pets. Every one of them. Anyway, and he would stay up with them as long as they were feral.
Mm-hmm.
Night and day until they were all through.
Mm-hmm. Grandma Dogan knew that.
And there were like 200 hogs out there, you know, having
uh-huh.
pigs. And so there were, I
it wasn't
recall.
Leonard. It wasn't Leonard Beadle.
Might have been Leonard.
Because he was a pig man par excellence.
Well, this guy was.
And,
could have been Leonard.
And he
Maybe
might have
Howard.
Been coming out from town. And
he might have lived in town.
And he took care of, he's the one that got us really doing a lot with pigs in those years.
Yeah.
And then it was his son, Billy Beadle, that was by in the summer of, well, it would have, I wonder how, if Leonard would have still been there by then, because it was the summer of 40, summer of 41, that I was 13 and was following Billy Beadle around in the barn, so his father would have been there by then, I think.
Yeah. I came
but
in,
maybe not.
The summer of 45.
You came the summer of 45. Yeah. I don't know if Leonard Beadle was still there or not.
I mean, I worked there about a month in January and February before the draft board called me up.
So you were just there a couple of months?
Yeah, I was there during the 3 months in the summertime and about a month in the winter.
Oh, okay.
At any rate, we were testing for brucellosis.
Uh-huh.
And there was a little problem here and there, you know. And we're a cow or, there was a cow or two that we had to ship.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they were the best producing cows, was always the case. We were getting a half cent a hundred for production, and if we could get over a certain amount of milk out of that bunch, and I went over those guys at the University of Wisconsin to draw bloods. They
mm-hmm.
drew them in the jugular vein of the cattle. The minute those guys got the test tube racks out of the trunk, they would rattle, of course. Every cow in the barn like that against the stanchions, you know. And then you knew, oh, boy, we're not going to get any milk out of these cows today.
Oh, that's a good story.
Oh, those
that's
poor cows. Story. Their eyes would get so big, and that guy could down there and stick them, you know, and then put the tube up there and catch a blood sample, you know. And, that was an interesting happening, because on that particular day,
uh-huh.
cows were not going to let their milk down. They were scared. The poor animals, I felt sorry for them. And, yeah, that's one recollection I have of doing it. And they always came at milking time, and cows were already in. You know? And so they'd arrive at milking time. And seemed like it was always in the afternoon, too. And because I don't think they were inclined to come out early in the morning. Because, you know, we were usually up at 4:30. And I don't think the herdsman lived on the place. I think he lived in town, too. Because I would usually go down first.
If it was Harlan, he didn't.
And get the cows in,
mm-hmm.
and you know, get them and let them all find their stanchions, and get them in the side barn, had a head in it too, you know,
mm-hmm.
that barn side, and get the cows in, and then clean up the gutters and get the cans ready, and give them the chlorine rinse and all that stuff you had to do to get everything ready, get the machines out, and then it seemed like he would arrive. I was in the process of doing that because I just came right out of the big house.
Mm-hmm.
I was living in the back, in the, with the bunkhouse part of it.
Upstairs? In
yeah,
the,
up there.
In the bunkhouse part, yeah.
And that's my recollection of kind of the, what the system was.
Mm-hmm.
And then the herds, he pretty much took care of all the stock that wasn't in production. The calves and the young heifers. and the cows who were about ready to drop their calves and all that. And it seemed like a lot of those were kept up at the house on the hill.
Yeah.
Where you guys
lived. That was where those were.
Yeah.
Up until they freshened, they were kept
up. I went up there for another. Maybe the herdsman wasn't available or he was gone for some reason and fed calves and stuff. Mm-hmm. I went up there and did that a couple times. But mostly that was the herdsman's job.
Mm-hmm.
I was up to me to get that barn cleaned up. Those big and span. And feed the cattle, and clean them up and get them all ready for milking and stuff. That was my job. And I loved that job. And I thought the interesting things about it was all the preparations you made to produce a sanitary product.
Mm-hmm.
The chlorine, rinsing out all the cans in solutions. Having a bucket of chlorine rinsed by the cows so when you wash down the udder, they were spick and span when you milked them. And of course, that's all stuff that Russell had taught me at Coal Valley when I worked there at the farm.
And he'd learned it at the farm when...
Yeah, he learned there when he worked there first time.
Because he was there when we were living in the little house there on the...
Oh, in the house right down on, by the dairy.
When I was in fifth grade...
Was there like an apartment above here?
Oh, yeah, there was one up above the milk house. There was an apartment, yeah.
Yeah, I seem to remember there was somebody that lived over there, a family that lived there. It was like in a three-room, four-room apartment.
Yeah, they turned
like
it into the office after a while. But it was an apartment for quite a while.
Okay. I don't remember much about where the office was. I had occasion to go there.
It might have been in the little house after we moved out.
Okay, which was also premises.
For quite a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Over on the other side.
Yeah.
Other side of the bar, the dairy.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you see, we had a day off each week.
Mm-hmm.
And since Moline was a long bus ride back and I was too chintzy to buy a ticket, I would usually volunteer to go in and work in the plant. So after we got the milking done, I'd go ahead and work in the plant and for the rest of the day until it was time to milk again and then go back down on the cows. So I was around there a lot. The other thing I remember about, we had a guy who was a Wisconsin state champion horseshoe thrower.
Huh.
And we would spend a period of time during the lunch hour pitching horseshoes out toward the road.
Okay.
It was a kind of a yard in there, as I recall. The roads was out here and the dairy building was back
was
a little ways. There was kind of a green space.
There was a green area.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had, I would think we had about three horseshoe pits there. And this guy could throw every time.
Hmm. Remember his name?
Can't remember his name. No, I don't remember a thing about that. One thing I do remember is one day we were playing and some kid ran across between the stakes when somebody was throwing a horseshoe and bonged or something off him. You know.
Hmm.
And it was a little kid. Wasn't anybody our age at that time. And I thought, well, it had to have been some Dogen kid that got bonked. Because, it might have been the people that lived up above the dairy plant there. Might have been one of those old kids.
Might have been
this kid was like 6 or 7 years old. Anyway, cut a gash in her head, and, it bled. And we had ice packs and all this kind of stuff. And I think finally took her downtown. But anyway, that was kind of a...
These are stories I haven't heard.
That was an accident. That was a really bad accident. And... of course, nobody thought that kid was going to run across in front of somebody throwing a horseshoe. But everything I learned about horseshoes was from that guy, whoever he was. But all I can remember about it is he was a state champion horseshoe slinger. He threw that, he could throw a horseshoe, bingo, it hit the stake, land on the stake. And I never met a guy that could throw horseshoes like that. I thought I knew a little bit about it from my earlier youth, but this guy taught us all lessons. Nobody could beat him. And maybe he went on to be a national champion after that.
So you were there the summer of 45.
Five, yeah.
And how old were you the summer of 45?
Let's see, I think about that.
When were you born?
So, I was born in 27.
So you're a year older than I am, about.
Yeah, about that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I was 17.
So you were 17.
I was going to be 18 in October.
Uh-huh.
In 45. Yeah.
And then you came back the following...
Came back...
January and February.
Yeah, we were... my wife and I were classmates in high school, in junior high and high school. And we were midtermers. We graduated in January. I got called up the minute my 18th birthday came. In the middle of October. So I went down to the draft board and I says, well, given that the war is over and I haven't graduated yet, you know, could I have a deferment until graduation? You know, so I could go to the graduation exercises in January. Well, yeah, we could probably work out something like that, you know. I said, fine. So, of course, I'm coming up on graduation. I called the draft board. What do you think I have to go? Well, we don't know that. Well, I go back to work on the farm where I've been because Russell still needed help. And, yeah, go ahead. He said, go ahead. And we'll just send the draft notice to your folks and they can on the phone. And that's about what happened. And that was in February. And so I was there about a month. Another great memory of that farm was a winter time. It's a winter. Got up at 4:30 and rolled out. I never had any trouble getting up.
Just a minute. I want to just be sure we're getting. Okay, we're on.
We're on. Okay. And I
got up at 4:30 Okay.
Yeah, I got up. Got out. It's dark, of course. I head down toward the barn and I look up, and just at that time, there is the most beautiful. Aurora Borealis I have ever seen in my whole life. Those were the streaks like you see, it was almost like a rainbow. And it went right over the round barn. See, it arched over the round barn. Just haloed that barn. I spent, in the military, I was in Alaska. 110 miles from the Arctic Circle. We spent a lot of time outdoors. I never saw northern lights that looked like that. Never.
What a wonderful thing to have had happen.
Yeah. And it was just, you know, I ran down, but the herdsman hadn't got there yet. Because I wanted to tell him about it, you know. Come on out, take a look at this. You know. And, of course, I don't think anybody else was up. Well, you know, the drivers might have been. Because they were in front of the truck.
They were probably loaded.
Yeah, they're loaded.
Ready to go.
I would guess. Anyway, whoever else was there, I know I announced to everybody, hey, look at that. And anybody that was inside her could hear it. And gosh, that was a beautiful thing. You know, it was just...
I would love to have seen that.
Oh, that was something. I just, you know, it didn't last long. I went out a little bit later after I got done with some of the chores and looked, it's gone. There weren't any northern lights. And, but that was, it's sort of like an artist would depict it as looking, I guess. And I've never seen northern lights like that since. The only time in my life I ever saw northern lights that looked like that. They were brilliant. They lit up the sky. And of course, when you got chores to do, you got to do chores. My kids didn't look too long. And of course, we had to get their cows ready to milk and all that kind of stuff. And we would have some problem with mastitis. Especially with some of the freshening cows, because they were, you know, they were given a lot of milk for them, and infections were easy to get, and we didn't have anything like penicillin. You know, back in those days, you couldn't shoot them with penicillin.
Well, there was a little bit because Doc Nylund's had a little bit.
I recall you reading about that, and I thought at the time, you know, later years, every farmer had those little. Those little syringes that you slipped up into the tip, you know, and you squeezed it shut, and then you kind of massaged it around, make sure it got in there good shape. But I don't recall ever having anything that we could do like that.
Yeah, well, he might have had some.
Might have had to call a veterinarian to take care of that. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I got that material from his son, and from other vets.
You were riding with him that year, weren't you?
Yeah, well, the vets around here. That were elderly, and one in Janesville explained to me about it.
Yeah.
And I think Dick, who was older than I was, told me that they did get a little, the vets got a little penicillin, the doctors got, because it was all going to the Army.
Yeah.
And so so by, well, the time riding with the vet, I would have been 17, that would have put you 18.
Yeah.
So maybe there was just that much difference in the wartime years. that there was might some for the...
Another recollection I had of up at the house on the hill, there was some pasture land behind there.
Yeah.
That the dry cows and so forth grazed, and there were there's a ton of bull thistles up in there, and there were some Canadian thistles too. And some guy down from the university with this new, which I think was
2,4-D was what I was just going to say,
and
it probably was.
And they found somewhere, they got a hold of a water wagon, and they mixed this stuff up, and they went out and sprayed all them bull thistles with that stuff. My experience with bull thistles was you went out with a spade and a file, and you kept your spade sharp, and you cut every one of them off. And when you got to the when you got to those, you got soil until they all died from salt. And that was the only way to stop Canadian thistles. Because that was Russell's approach to those.
Mm-hmm. But did the 2,4-D do something with
them? It knocked those bull thistles down. The next day they were all... You know, and it was a miracle. You know, so help me, it was a miracle that anything could be sprayed on them that would do that. Those who could have sprayed fuel on them, and they would have died too. But anyway, this stuff was some new pesticide, you know, weed killer. For all I know, they were using it in the Army. I don't really know. I didn't find that out. We didn't use it anywhere I was.
Mm-hmm.
But, that was good stuff.
And that was new in the
Grandpa
in the summer of 45.
Yeah,
when you were there.
Yeah, Grandpa Dogan, had a one-on-one relationship with the university, and I suppose they wanted to try it somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe those guys who was at the university are the ones that bought it right now.
Mm-hmm.
But when they came down with it, you know, and they used it, geez, this is a revolution of the weed killing business.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. All that work on such or so-and-so, you know. How about all that? We used to get all that hemp weed growing on the fence and kill that too. Well, it kills broadleaf plants. Mm-hmm. And, we could knock out all the morning glory.
You know, it
stuff like that. Yeah, feel the corn, you could just go down and spray that stuff on the horse and they all die. You wouldn't have to cut them. So, at the time, that was...
really a big scientific breakthrough. I thought I observed one of those really big scientific breakthroughs.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big thing, really big thing. So I have a recollection of that. And so far as I know, that's the first time it ever used on a farm.
Well, they were using DDT shortly after that freely, too, without knowing the dangers.
We did DDT in the military.
Out
in the Pacific, when the bugs got too bad, you know, they call the Army Air Force and send a DC over and just dump it on the island. Killed everything. Every bug problem,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, terrible.
And, of course, all the men got covered with it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Without realizing what the carcinogenic side effects were. And I knew about DDT.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, seems to me like we used that around the cattle to get rid of the flies and stuff. You know, if a cow was content, wasn't having to flick flies away all the time. Well,
she was better.
They did better.
Did better.
Mm-hmm. Produced more milk. Well, I think we had some stuff that we could spray on the cows that kept the flies off. And we had this Bruce thing. We did have. I used to go down and get the cows in the summertime in the pasture, the night pasture right out behind the barn, and found an aborted calf in the pasture, you know, and. Which cow it was, and so we brought her up, and then those guys from Wisconsin came and drew her blood and found out, she had brucellosis.
I've got a Bruce. See, I've got a whole lot more than was in that book.
I read something about that somewhere.
If you read the acknowledgements, it says there's a whole lot more.
Yeah, we're working some more. Yeah.
If
you're working on some
and,
more
So I can pull you out some of those, and you can, especially the ones from your time. I was thinking that my dad's diary for a year. But he started it in January of 47, and you would have been there in January of 46.
Yeah.
But, so I was beginning to think, we've got that month, but we don't. Because Dad really didn't keep a diary, but there's a farm work diary,
mm-hmm.
and that's Grandpa's list of everything everybody did, and I haven't done much with that yet. There's a lot more I can do with this book, but it's already 2,500 pages.
Well, I think for me, it's kind of a part of a continuing life story. I went in the Army, got you qualified to go in the Corps of Engineers because you took a lot of science courses in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So I had physics and chemistry and math. And so I wound up over in Virginia, which was the Corps of Engineers training center for military engineers, and learned to purify water. And we had a couple, three different ways to do it. On board ship, you did it by distance. Didn't have osmosis units back in those days, but anyway. They did have sand filters, and those were portable, and they had diatomaceous earth filters for clearing raw water, cleaning raw water. Then I got assigned to Alaska, and we produced water out there for 1,500 in the Arctic. It's a kind of a testing thing. We wrote a lot of papers, and we tried different things, and water pipes freezes when it's 60 below zero.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that doesn't happen up there is the tundra doesn't allow you to sink into the abyss up to your knees. But it would be terribly cold, and we did get our explosives unit. One of the platoons had how to use explosives, and we'd blow holes in the ice in the creek and draw water out of that until it froze over. And we'd have them come back and blow another hole. And the ice froze thick, clear usually to the bottom of the creek, unless you find a little hot spring. And I was the guy who was assigned to find the hot springs. And I could do it by how much snow was on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd walk along these creek beds, and I'd think, well, I think there's one right about here. And sure enough, they'd blow it, and by God, there's water running underneath there. So, okay, drop your line in.
So you got a reputation.
Yeah, I got a reputation. It wasn't that you could see them, that's for sure. They weren't that hot.
Mm-hmm.
And we purified water for these 1,500 men, and who were off and on in the out in the tundra, not in camp, doing all these exercises to see how the military could deal with the cold. Frankly, before, we'd have probably more of them had died from frostbite than they would have aimed bullets. But we built an ice bridge, a river, with logs and water. And an interesting thing, the Russians were doing it, so we thought we had to do it too. And of course, they used all our pumps and stuff to pump the water with. From there, I came back to the States. I went to the U of I for campaign, College of Agriculture and Major in Dairy Science. That's
you,
where I really
did. You know Joe Tobias?
Oh, sure. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I've got a good story to tell you about him, but I won't put it on the tape. I mean, because I want you on the tape.
Yeah, okay.
And I can tell you that. We should call him up.
Yeah, talk to him. Is he here in town?
No, he's over there.
Oh, he's over in Champaign.
Yeah, but I've been in contact with him.
Oh, have you? Wow.
He's in the acknowledgments.
I see. Yeah, I remember that. I think I saw the name in there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, the... following, that's when my romance really bloomed with the girl. Salisbury, yeah.
Salisbury was
he came
there
over
too.
From Ohio State.
Okay, well, go on. This your romance bloomed with your childhood sweetheart.
Yeah, with my high school sweetheart, junior high school sweetheart. I think I told my mother when I was in seventh grade that I'd found the girl I was going to marry. Now, I never went out with her until I went to college. We just were good friends.
Mm-hmm.
But she was going through U of I at the time, but you know, she was in agriculture and foods and nutrition, that love bloomed. So she's a class of 50, and I'm a class of 51.
Uh-huh.
I came back after that stint in the military, and I thought I had to take all the courses that were available to me and just load up. Mm-hmm. I was kind of a workaholic anyway. So I carried 21 hours and all kinds of stuff like this. With all the science courses, it was a load.
Mm-hmm.
But I got through that in fair shape. And graduated, went to work for Swift and Company down in Mount Vernon, Illinois, at a dairy and poultry plant. They had a division, dairy and poultry division. They were making ice cream there, and they were churning butter, and it wasn't grade eight products. And so I was a field person, and I dearly loved that. They had me on a territory that went from Evansville, Indiana, down to Clarksville, Tennessee, right straight south. I called on sharecroppers, African-American sharecroppers. They were the major shippers, and they shipped by rail. L&N Railroad brought the cream up. It had nothing to do with a grade A product. They were not even close. There was no refrigeration. Separation was by gravity. You know, they skimmed the milk off the top of the can that sat behind the stove. That's how they separated cream back in those days. It was not what I was accustomed to at the university, needless to say.
Or at the Dogan Farm.
No, not the Dogan Farm either. Or at Russell, you know, wherever Russell ran something, it had to be just right. So that was a really eye-opening experience. That's when I found out what the plight of the African American was in the South. And we wouldn't join a church in Evansville until they agreed to open their membership to African Americans. Not that any joined, but they.
But they did open the membership.
They did open the membership, or we wouldn't join. And so that was our contribution to the improvement of race relations. And which was kind of tiny and pretty naive, to be frank about it. At any rate, that went for a couple of years. Then Swift was shutting down things. They were closing plants and consolidating and all kinds of stuff. So I got laid off from that job. And we went back north again to Moline, and I worked at Iowana Farms Milk Company. A fellow by the name of Glenn Moore owned the company. It was in Bettendorf, Iowa. Glenn was a pioneer guy, kind of like Grandpa Dogan. A lot like that. He'd been in the dairy business all his life. At the time, he did not own any farms, but he had owned farms, and he had raised cattle and dairy cattle and done some dairy herd improvement work. And so it was fun to talk to him. You know, again, he was a guy ready to retire. And so I worked over there for several years. Then I got this job as a milk sanitarian, which opened up over in the city of Moline. And the job opened up, and I went over and interviewed for it. And, you know, I thought I could do some good. I thought I could do some good by improving the quality of product. And I worked for the city there for about 10 years. That's when the public health horizons kind of widened. Concerned about not only milk sanitation, but other food sanitation. Yeah. Well, there's a kitty cat. How you doing? Yeah, what a good kitty. Yeah.
Oh, that's the first time I've seen of you, Chesney, today.
Yeah. Aren't you going to give me anything? Anyhow. So that broadened my horizons. The city at the time had no routine sanitary food law, and nobody did any work on it. They had a guy called a health inspector, but he did not do any routine inspection work. And of course, I was doing the grade A program at that time. I had five dairy plants, and I had about 150 farms, all the way up to the Wisconsin border. So I was doing all that sort of product improvement activity with the public health safety in mind. And then I started working on the food thing in the city after the old health inspector retired. And that kind of shocked them, because when I came in to start making inspections, they were, what are you doing here? What's the problem? I said, there isn't any problem that I know of yet. but I'm here to make a routine inspection. What the heck's that? They never had a routine inspection their whole life. I says, well, the ordinance provides that I'm to make a routine inspection. I said, based upon what I've been doing in the dairy field, I said, I think I need to come here about four times a year to look this place over, see how you're doing. Oh, well, that was unheard of, sort of revolutionary.
That was a shock to them.
Yeah, it was. And the mayor got several phone calls, you know, but I went in and discussed that with him, and I said, well, we got some liability here, you know, we're a public agency, and we have, under the statutes and the Constitution in Illinois, we have an order to protect the public health.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we're doing. But I, don't worry about it. We use an educational approach. These guys will catch on for too long. So I can teach them just as well as I did those farmers out there in the country.
Mm-hmm.
They used to call once in a while, too, if they thought I was too tough. But, you know, like I say, I learned all that milk sanitation stuff really from Russell and from WJ.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Grandpa was a stickler for doing it just right.
He certainly was.
And as you say, probably Russell learned from him. But yeah, he may have taught the course. But at any rate, that stuck with me and has ever since. I got a fur collar here. Hi there, kitty. Oh, I got a kitty cat that does this. It's the very same thing.
Okay.
Yes, we love our daddies, don't we? Yes, daddies are fun. Yeah. You're not the only one that likes to rub his cheek up against. No, I do it too. Yeah. I've got a dog also. It's a golden retriever.
Mm-hmm.
And our boy cat is not afraid of the dog. And he goes out, and the dog is scared to death of the cat. He goes out to the dog, and we'll rub up against his leg, you know. And we'll wrap his tail around, you know, like they do when they want to do loving. Mm-hmm. And it walk under the dog, walk around back, rub up against her back leg, scare the dog to death. She won't move. She just stands there like this.
Mm-hmm.
That cat's going to get me for sure. You know, mm-hmm. Never does, of course. And, but he, the boy cat, has got her, the girl dog, scared to death.
Well, anytime you want Chezzy off there, I'll move her.
You're a good kitty. Yes, you are. Mm-hmm. You're a good kitty. So about 10 years with the city, and we were doing a lot of things at that time, doing some new things at that time. There were model cities programs, and we were trying to improve housing in the city and working in some of the old parts of town, trying to get housing up to standard so people wouldn't die in fires and all kinds of stuff. And then they started the county health department, and I went over and became its administrator.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly they were interested in me because I knew a lot of environment stuff about water supplies and sewage treatment and food sanitation.
Mm-hmm.
And which was our major interest at the time. We had three or four nurses when we started who were doing home calls.
Mm-hmm.
And basically home health nursing is what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started branching out into some public health activities. And of course, it's a big operation now. And I did similar things in Jackson County and down in Carbondale and Fulton County up over by Peoria. Worked for 36 years in public health.
Mm-hmm. You've been retired how long now? A couple of years?
About 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
My wife kind of dragged me away at age 67, kicking and screaming. I just assumed kept on working. But her mom was not well, and she was kind of going downhill. She passed 90 by that time, and she lived in Moline, so Mary felt like she had to get back, you know, and be closer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a good thing, because she died, a year ago? She died last April. Yeah. And it was a good thing. So we were right there when she died. And you're purring like crazy. Yeah, you like that, don't you? Yeah, you do. Anyhow, that's kind of where the Dilgan Farm and the dairy farm and Russell and
started you all off.
Started me off.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was just a natural mm-hmm. progression for me. No problem at all.
Do you remember any particular incidents with Grandpa, with WJ? Anything he said or did?
Well,
or?
It was. I recalled right away that everybody had to write him notes.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes he could read your lips. but mostly not.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody carried a pencil and paper. I did.
Mm-hmm.
And he would, if you get him start talking about the past, you know, he'd talk about farming and the barn and the round barn and all that stuff. He could.
Mm-hmm. That's when I should have been taking down stories, and I wasn't. I missed them.
I don't recall much detail of that, except mm-hmm. that he did it. You know, he can recall all those things that he did.
Mm-hmm. You said he came out every day and often in second gear.
Yeah.
The car grinding out.
Yeah, he set the thing, and he'd forget to put it in high.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear the car coming up the road, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And a cloud of dust, of course. And yeah, he'd forget, and then we'd tell him when he got there, you should have shifted into high. Oh, yeah. Oh, I bet that was hard on the transmission. Yeah, probably was. I don't know how often he had the car in for repair work, but anyway, it's too bad we didn't have automatic transmissions back in those days.
Yeah, that would have taken care of it for him. Yeah.
I recall threshing oats during the summer there, that one summer I was there, with this humongous threshing gang. These guys came from all over. I didn't know any of them. With their wagons. And there was this huge steam tractor. You remember the steam tractor?
I probably do.
Out behind your house where you lived. We built the biggest straw stack I ever done.
Well, I certainly must have seen that because I was there then.
I worked some in the field, and then Russell decided, well, go over and work on the stack, Fred. We got to get that stack straightened out so it looks halfway decent. You know, get over there on the stack and work on it. And with the blower, you know, he had the blower and blow that straw over there. And this guy that took care of the steam tractor, really, there was another guy who was kind of a perfectionist. You know, he was going around oiling all of those places, keeping this thing fired with coal. And that tractor, when he went down the road, you know, would travel 3 or 4 miles an hour, no more than that. And he'd walk alongside of it rather than ride on it because it was bumpy.
Mm-hmm.
It had those cleat wheels, and it was bumpy. But boy, for driving a belt, there was nothing better,
mm-hmm.
you know. It pulled the belt on that thrash machine like nobody's business. And of course, I think the thrashing machine didn't belong on the farm either. I think this
no, they kept guy it with somewhere
the steam
else.
Tractor and the thresher, they seemed to go together. Whether that guy owned the whole rig, I don't know anything about that. But I remember going out and getting those old bundles in the field
mm-hmm.
and stacking them on the wagon and stuff like that.
Yeah, there was an art to binder. Stacking them on the wagon, too.
Oh, yeah. I had to put them on there, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot of fun. They had a lot of fun out there. That was an interesting thing. And I can remember this long table of guys for lunch, you know, for dinner, after working all morning on that mm-hmm. snack.
Big bunch of people.
Big bunch of guys, yeah. The women were busy, I kid mm-hmm. you not. They were hauling a lot of grub out of that kitchen.
Did you eat outdoors?
Yeah, we ate outside.
On trestles out on the lawn?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right next to the clothesline. I remember mm-hmm. the clothesline because I turned around and, without looking and tripped myself up with a darn thing. Caught me right in the neck. Dumped me right flat on my rear. The guys thought that was funny. Probably did look kind of ridiculous. Okay, kitty cat. You going to come down now?
Ready to go?
Come on. Come on.
No, she come doesn't want to.
Come on.
Come on, Chizzy.
Come on, Chizzy. There you go.
This is my eldest daughter's cat. I'm pet-sitting this cat. Indefinitely.
You're a
and,
good kitty.
And I've got a cat in the living room that just came last night that I'm going to be keeping about 2 weeks that belongs to my youngest daughter.
You're a good. He purred the whole time.
Yeah,
you did. You just purred and purred and purred.
You're going to go up on my
you're
neck?
You're a lover,
now?
Aren't you?
You're going to go up on my neck?
Yeah,
now?
You're
you
a lover.
You can go up on mine if you want.
Yeah, there come I on. Go.
Here, come on around. Come on. Why is Fred's neck any better than mine, huh?
Okay. There you go.
Okay.
There you make a nice little scarf. Yeah.
Did you see anything of Ron, of RA? He was pretty busy because he didn't have
help. I didn't
help.
See him much.
And he would be working in the office. And
yeah. And he
trying to keep things going.
I see him coming and going.
Uh-huh.
But
you didn't get to
not,
know him
not
or talk to
where
him.
Where I can stop and talk with him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, I don't recall conversations with him. Your dad? I can't remember your mom either.
Well, she wouldn't have been around much. She would have been up at the other farm. And
yeah,
and
the other house. Yeah.
So forth.
Yeah. I can recall a boxer dog.
Oh, yeah. We had boxer dogs.
Up at that house.
Yeah.
There wasn't any down by the dairy, but there was up at that house. Now, he was a nice dog. He came bounding out, you know, when he came in up to drive.
The
I
whole
can say there were a couple or three times I went up to take care of the calves and the cows, dry cows and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was, they did all the corn processing up there. The hybrid corn processing was
done up at, and
you weren't in on
that. I
was there
in the summertime, see, and so didn't get involved in.
But you weren't in on detasseling.
No,
the detasseling crews came out and had nothing to do with you.
I didn't know any of those kids.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting reading about it. I knew kids that did detasseling, you know, down and around Moline, but I never got involved in a detasseling project.
Yeah, because you were doing the barn work.
Making silage,
mm-hmm.
putting up hay.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember running the feed grinder, you know, the electric
up on the
motor.
Up on the barn floor?
Yeah, up on the barn floor, on the mile floor there.
Where are you going?
You know, and you couldn't feed the corn in there too fast because it would blow the fuse. And I had those little cartridge fuses that kept that motor going. And I was used to grinding feed with a tractor,
mm-hmm.
you know, which didn't stop for anything. And Russell kept telling me, you know, you can't feed it too fast now, Fred. It won't take it. It won't take it so fast. You got to go easy. Go easy. Then I get in a hurry, and then blow a cartridge fuse. And they were somewhat of a premium, as I recall. And Russell was not happy when I blow those cartridge fuses. Well, I'm trying to get this job done, you know, get the supplement in there and get it all mixed right and everything. Just, you know, we get in too big a hurry, Brad, too big a hurry. But, and I can remember a tractor, or I think it was a remodeled truck, is what it was. Might have been a remodeled car.
They were pretty good during the war at fixing things up.
Yeah, this thing, you know, had a seat in it, but that was about it. And,
No.
We go down there to round up the cows and get them up in the pasture, driving that whole thing. And it had. Somebody had done two transmissions so that you could get it right down at Granny Low, you know, by switching,
mm-hmm.
shifting both of them. And I never used it that way. I used it to run out and get the cattle when they were clear out across the tracks,
mm-hmm.
up north. And so I remember the tracks and the train going through there periodically. I was a guy who, for Liberta, had to go out and find a rooster for dinner, whack their heads off.
Hey, watch it.
And every time she wanted a chicken, she'd say, "Fred, on your way out after lunch, get a chicken. You got to get a chicken dressed for tomorrow."
So Sunday you just dinner. Grab a chicken.
Well, yeah, you try to get a good rooster, nice rooster,
mm-hmm.
grab the hens, and. At first, it was easy to get them. After a while, you know, they're getting kind of few and far between. It's a little hard to corner one.
Mm-hmm.
And so you spend a little time chasing them around. I did fashion a piece of wire to catch them on the leg. And God, there wasn't a leg hook on that farm that I can remember. I can remember going somewhere and finding some number 9 wire and getting a flyer, making it.
Is a leg hook usually a standard thing for?
Yeah, pretty usual around poultry. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Usually it's right inside the poultry house, right inside the door. He just got it and went, caught one and didn't have to even bend over hardly. Yeah.
I just brought in a nose leader to show to Fred that we pulled out of the round barn, my brother and I.
I can tell you a story about leader staff, you know. In Coal Valley, we had this 2,400-pound brown Swiss bull.
Mm-hmm.
He was leased. We didn't buy him. He was leased, and we only get him for so long a time. And we had a rope, put his nose, you know, a little hook on the end of a rope, and put in his nose ring and lead him over to water across the barnyard.
Mm-hmm.
Russell decided that was a little dangerous, although he was a pretty docile bull all the time. If he'd make a lunge at you, you know, you might catch it when you're looking.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down to Sears and bought one of them metal staffs with a little hook on the end.
Mm-hmm.
We'll pull the trigger up on this end, about 3 feet long. And he said, you know, I'll show you.
Remind me to look at that thing that I've never been able to identify and see if that's what it is. That's on
anyway,
the tape now. Okay.
He said, lead the bull with this instead of the rope. Pull the rope is a whole lot easier. But, okay, Russell, I know what you tell me. The bull barn did not have water in it yet. They had just built it, and we had a young bull that was about a year and a half old in there, plus this little girl. And I led him the first day. I led that bull with that staff. I was just leaning against the barn while he was drinking. And he looked up. I wasn't even looking at him. And I just kind of had this thing up against me like this. And I hold my hand. And I don't think I was even looking at him. And he raised his head up like he would when he stopped drinking. And he usually liked to look around at the cow, see what the, you know, where the cows were.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly that none of them were in the barnyard. And he took one jump at me, that big, and put his head right through the barn where I'd been standing. And that thing just shoved me down the barn, skinned me up a little bit. And,
but you were saved by having that stick?
That staff saved
that
my
staff.
Life. I think it saved my life. His head was inside the barn, wise. It flipped out of my hand, of course. I wasn't hanging on to it.
Did you break the wood?
Oh, man, he broke the siding right out of that barn. His head was inside the barn. Not only the outside siding, there was there were heavy vertical tongue and groove boards on the inside that went up maybe 4 feet high on the wall. This is a nice barn. He even
splintered down. This was down at the Cove Alley.
Down at Cove Alley.
Okay.
Splintered down. Yeah. He went clear through.
Wow.
And when he got through looking around inside the barn, he yanked his head out of there, too. And
boy,
wood went flying or which way. And then he was perfectly fine. He went back to drinking. You know, I picked up the staff and everything was fine.
I bet you were scared.
Wow, I'll say, I told Russell, boy, did we wreck the barn today. Whatever. He just, out of clear blue sky, just took a jump at me. And I didn't really see what he was going to do. I wasn't paying attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, never had that problem before.
You probably paid attention to bulls from then on.
Boy, I'll say, keep your eye on them. A little one, too. A little year and a half old. He could have done the same thing.
I'm trying to remember who it was that Milt Konecki saved from a bull. I think it was Bob Opelt. I've got that story.
Wow.
Or it might have been Cleo Reinfeldt.
I have to get you down. Jeez.
Yeah. You don't remember Milt Konecki. He was probably just ahead of you.
Wonderful.
And I've got all their dates, but I don't
I
have...
I can recall guys coming back from the military and taking jobs and coming out from town. Most of these guys were veterans.
Mm-hmm.
So they were like 23, 24, 25.
Mm-hmm.
Some were married, some didn't. But then, you know, all of a sudden things started lightening up. You know, that was it in August 45? The Germans had capitulated in May of 45, right?
I've never gotten it. I can't quite remember how
and
it happened.
And the Japanese surrendered like in August of 45. I was working there at the 45, yeah. I was working there then. Because I remember the big celebration. You know, somebody come roaring out of the house, I can't remember who, announcing that the Japanese surrendered. The war is over. A bunch of guys went down to town. You know, but I don't think anybody...
It wasn't August 46?
Couldn't have been because I went in the military in August of 46.
Okay, it was all over by then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Before it ended. That's why I wasn't That's why I never quite understood why I was getting drafted.
Mm-hmm.
Except I guess we were just replacement troops for the guys coming out.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting thing to do. It was, Corps of Engineers was interesting. It's a school at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, was really interesting.
And you weren't really in combat danger because there wasn't any more combat.
Oh, well, they talked about the Russians coming over.
Yeah, they were getting excited about the Russians.
Yeah, they were going to come in and take Alaska back.
Good grief. I don't remember that.
Yeah. So there was quite a lot Army Air Force up there at that time. That's when jets were first being commissioned, you know. And these guys were flying these F-80 shooting star things. And they would send a few up there to test them out.
Uh-huh.
And they'd run rings around those P-51s in the sky, you know, because they were so fast. And it was fun to watch them. And
do you remember any particular story that happened up at the farm?
We had a cow. You know, we used Surge Milkers.
You used Surge Milkers,
yeah,
okay.
Down in Coal Valley, we used Dillavals. They sat on the floor.
But these hung from a surcingle.
The strap, yeah.
The surcingle.
Right. And there was a new cow that freshened. It was a Holstein, although it wasn't big like a Holstein. It was more built like a Guernsey, but it was a black and white cow.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably a mixture of the two. I never seen this cow before. Came into the little side barn and had 10 cows in it. Just fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had never seen this animal before. And I'm milking cows. And we did the round barn first, and we went down to 10 cows in the lower barn.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a fast-moving guy. I'm staying still very long. You know? So I'm going down the thing and prepping these cows and getting them all ready. And strip them down a couple times, you know, make sure the milk's okay and all this kind of stuff, you know. And I go swinging in behind this cow with this bucket and the strap. And strap over the back, and I set that bucket down on the floor, and that cow went crazy. She kicked me out of there like nobody's business. And for what reason, I had not a clue. I didn't know what was the matter with that cow.
Mm-hmm.
Cows don't do that.
Did she break any ribs or anything?
Didn't break anything, but she sure booted me out of there.
Hmm.
And so I'm sitting back there against the wall thinking, how am I going to milk this cow? Hirschman was up stripping behind me, up on the main floor. And I went back in there again, you know, try to see what I could do. You know,
mm-hmm.
See if I couldn't get that machine on the thing. No way. All I came in, she just went nuts. So I thought, well, I get the kickers on, you know, those little kickers with a chain?
No, I don't know. Describe
them to
me. Well, I had
a little chain that went around their legs, this way.
No, wait, around the
cow's back legs.
It would go around the cow's back legs,
yeah,
both of them together?
Yeah. And then it was a little metal thing, and you put one on each leg, on the back of each leg, right behind their, right below their knee bone, you know, where that narrow part of their leg is.
Yeah.
Those just fit in there. And that chain went around the front.
And you had some of those there at the round barn?
Yeah, there was something like that.
I don't remember ever seeing them. Well, go on.
Well,
this is fascinating.
Thought this isn't going to happen to me again. Stuck them on there. Went back in there. Gonna milk that cow. She goes nuts again. Of course, this time she can't kick.
Mm-hmm.
So she kicked herself down. So there she's laying in the stanchion, you know, with her neck pulled against the stanchion, and she's halfway in the gutter, and she can't get up, I can't get her up, and I can't get those chain loose because it's just stretched too tight. And so then I had to go up and get her. What are we going to do? Well, between the two of us, we were able to get her legs close enough together so we could get those darn things off her so she could stand up. And I let her out of the stanchion. And there's no problem going in the stanchion. No problem. You could walk all around her. You could touch her anywhere. It was okay. She came in with that milking machine. Man, she was nuts.
Well, had you
this
milked her before?
Cow.
Oh, it was a
never
new cow. Okay,
cow.
Never
yeah,
milked that
just
cow
freshened.
Before. Just freshened, okay.
And it was a new cow. I don't think the herdsman knew what her problems were.
Uh-huh.
I found out that if the bucket scraped the concrete, that's what started her off. If I set the bucket down quietly and didn't scrape the concrete while I'm adjusting the surfing wall, putting it up and getting it off the floor. It didn't scrape the floor. She was okay.
That's a good story.
Yeah. But why, if you had the bucket, scrape the floor. So always, that cow, summer or during the winter, I put straw under there.
So that wouldn't make a noise.
If the bucket did slide, it wouldn't make any noise.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just that, sliding of that. Now, it didn't seem to bother her if the bucket slid in the cow next to her. Only
it was
just
for her,
her
own bucket. The one under
there
her.
Was something that happened in that cow's life that totally terrorized that animal when that bucket did that underneath her.
That's a great story.
I have no idea what caused that cow to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, we named it because I think it was a new animal. It was a replacement animal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe it wanted to be shipped because of brucellosis or had we maybe had a couple positive TBs or something like that. You know, we had
a moment or two. Yeah. Fred says they were doing TB tests at that
back
time
then,
too.
Yeah.
Up about, said something about a bone or?
Pin bones, yeah, they worked off the pin bone in the back, you know, they put the little serum underneath the skin, you know,
mm-hmm.
And then about 3 days later you had to look to see if there's a swelling there.
Mm-hmm. What's the pin bone?
A hip bone.
The hip bone?
Hip bone.
Okay.
Out, yeah. And,
so where the skin was very thin?
Yeah.
I mean, there wasn't any much flesh under it.
Wasn't a whole lot of fur on it either, you know.
Yeah.
It was all bumping those places.
Okay.
Taking the fur off. And they were doing a skin test on cattle for tuberculosis.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, Grandpa started that early.
I'm sure he did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was.
He pioneered in
health,
talking
stuff.
About
yeah,
it. Yeah.
He was drawn to it. And so. Cows that had any kind of health problems. Well, in the case of brucellosis, had to be shipped. In the case of tuberculosis, had to be shipped too. You couldn't keep them.
Mm-hmm.
And if they had udder infections and stuff like that, well, you pull them aside and milk them separately.
Mm-hmm. Let the cats have the bad
milk
or whatever.
The bad milk, yeah. We had some interesting cats down there. That would stand on the outside edge of the gutter on a walkway when you first started milking. And didn't really care to wait for a milk in the little pan.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, if you took the tit, you know, and turned it and squirted, the cat would stand there with his on his hind feet, you know, with his feet up, front
mm-hmm.
feet up, and catch it in his mouth, you know. Usually got it all over his face.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't that good that I could hit him in the mouth. Everything.
Yeah, Ron, my dad, he could hit him right in the mouth.
I recall a story in that book about that.
Yeah, he was good at hitting him right in the mouth.
Right in the mouth. And so when I did that, the cats usually wound up with it all over their faces.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't seem to bother him any. They'd go over and
lick their chops.
Right.
Yeah. Let's try Russell.
I can remember those cats coming down there for quick. Yeah. You're just like my cat. Yeah. Except he's tan.
All these people that talk so long.
He's tan colored. Yeah. The tan colored cat. Yeah, I kind of lost track of the Uriuses after that trip up there with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
I found the round barn. Let's see. Going up Interstate 90. I think before Interstate 90 was finished is when I went up and we saw Liberta and Russell.
Mm-hmm.
Visited a little while. Got to meet the kids, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And those kids have all done well. They all got a good work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
they work hard. I've got an environmental chemist out in Sacramento. She's working on two Superfund sites out there. The Air Force is deactivating a lot of their
mm-hmm.
bases out there, and before they can return them to public ownership, they have to be cleaned up.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in the military, if we spilled more fuel and you'd shake a stick at it, we didn't worry anything about it. Nobody thought about it. No issue. Mm-hmm. We dumped more DDT on the ground, in big barrels full, without ever thinking about that either. So that's what her job is, cleaning up after me. I've got a son at Portland, Oregon, who's he's the one that graduated from SSU here in psychology.
Clinical psych. What's his name?
He's Fred Siebenman too.
Fred Siebenman too.
He's Fred Siebenman the third.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm really junior,
mm-hmm.
but senior died. So so he'd gone to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
He thought he ought to go to war. After I told him that wasn't a good idea, but that didn't make any difference. Everybody told him that. He went anyway, and he really needed a master's degree in psychology to come down off of that war. Now he's doing heating and air conditioning.
Hmm.
Yeah. He's a roll up your sleeves working stiff. And people come to his house to talk about their psychological problems. He's a freelance.
The freelance psychologist, consultant.
Yeah, freelance consultant. Uh-huh. They come in and talk about all their problems. So, he does that. He's married out there. And I've got a granddaughter in Sacramento. Now, he doesn't have any kids. So, there aren't any more Siebenmans
mm-hmm.
on our side of the family.
Let's see, you got a third kid or just the two?
I got a third one. The middle daughter is down in Key Largo, Florida, which is where I'm going to be on the 15th.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going down for a couple of weeks and do... daddy do jobs, you know. Got daddy do jobs. And I've got two grandsons and a son-in-law down there. And Key Largo is the first key from Miami,
mm-hmm.
down from Miami. And we bought a house down there. We bought a house with them.
Now your wife is still living?
Oh, yeah.
She's yeah, okay. Is she going to go yeah. too on this
No, she's
Florida
not going to go. She has to look after the dog.
Okay.
She says she has to anyway.
Okay.
Otherwise, she's got to make arrangements for the dog, and she won't put him in a kennel. Because no, the dog won't do well there. Okay, I understand that. But anyway, so when we travel, you know, we kind of travel separately. Unless it's for the day. We can go for a day, you know,
mm-hmm.
leave the dog in the pen, but not overnight. She don't want to leave the dog alone. And, you know, we're tied to that poor dog. But anyway... So I've got jobs to do down there. We bought a house with my daughter down there, who's running a successful insurance business. And they sell a lot of homeowners and boat insurance and anything you want, really. And she kind of runs the office. Her boss, the guy that owns the company, she says, pretty much I just kind of keep him out of all the office work, let him
mm-hmm.
go out and make his contacts with his folks at the golf club and all that kind of stuff. And he can get new clients that way. But, and then her husband is a Miami-Dade policeman,
mm-hmm.
about 25 years service, I suppose. He's been a policeman for a long time. And now I've got two grandsons there, 14 and...
Mm-hmm. Well, they'll be looking forward to seeing you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, ball games. And I've got baseballs going full tilt down there now. And so they're getting ready to start the Little League baseball.
Mm-hmm.
They play a lot of soccer down there.
Yeah, we play a lot here at Salem, too. I mean, at UIS, what we are now.
That's a new game to me. I don't know much about it, and I don't know what the rules are, but it looks like fun. Make sure burn off a lot of calories. Run up and down the seals. So what do you think, huh? How's the kitty cat?
Still
you
busy.
Doing?
Come on, Ulysses. Get off the phone. I'll get Penny Troy.
Was down there one day.
This is when Fred was in high school and was taking ag classes after school, I guess.
Yep, after school.
And so they had some horse-drawn
milk wagons.
Milk wagons.
Yeah. And they had these big Belgian horses.
Uh-huh.
You know, one horse to a wagon. And so he shows us how you take the harness and throw it over the horse and hook them all up and stuff. Now these horses have been harnessed every day of their life, practically.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew how the harness was to fit.
Mm-hmm.
And you put the horse collar on And you hold the bridle up and they just push their faces right into it.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to know a whole lot about harnessing horses. You're truthful about it because they made it fit.
Mm-hmm.
And you throw your harness up over the horse, all horses. And if it didn't get on there just right or wasn't quite straight, they'd kind of shake it around till they got it to fit right, you know. Mm-hmm. And then you could buckle it all up. And so that's where I learned to harness horses from horses that probably could have harnessed themselves if they had a way to get a hold of the harness and hang it up there.
That picture of the Ron Barn book with the harness all.
Yeah.
All down the side. Yeah. Was that for fly protection?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
To have all that stuff
that,
hanging,
that, hanging
down,
down
on the sides,
yeah,
and then they
the
could
flies off of them.
Uh huh.
They were still using horse-drawn milk wagons in Evansville, Indiana, when I was down there in 1952, 53, long ago.
I know that during the war. Wright and Wagner went back to horse-drawn wagons. I don't think we did.
Yeah. They had, I can recall this milkman coming to the house and he stopped and talked too long and the horse went on to the next stop. Well, it happened to be 2 blocks away.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what happened to Dad, too. He would stop and talk to people.
Yeah, well, I read something about that.
The horse would go on. You read about that.
He took off. Well, this horse went out on this very busy street, didn't stop at the corner, you know, just came up to the corner, went around the corner, you know, with all these cars going every which ways,
mm-hmm.
and screeching their brakes on and what have you, missing. And of course, milkman came out and the wagon was gone, you know? So down the road he goes, you know, down the street he goes. He ran across the street in front of all that traffic to catch up with the, he got up the wagon at the next stop.
That's a good story.
Yeah. But that's not unlike that story that's in the book, you know.
Uh-huh.
I saw this happen, you know. Those horses were so tolerant of people around them.
Mm-hmm.
I can recall little kids coming out to see the horse, and they'd walk under the horse between their legs, you know, and reach up and touch the horse's tummy.
Those are the big Belgian horses?
Yeah, and they just stand there.
Uh-huh.
They wouldn't.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. You know, I think those kids are going to get themselves killed under there.
Mm-hmm.
But a horse would not move. Just stand there. That was a shock to me that they could do that. There's Dogan's Farm Dairy. How about that?
Fred's down, talking about the manure wagon.
Here at how he got those horses to turn just in the right places to get that wagon back around there where that dump wagon came out of the barn.
Okay,
I'll never figure that out.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I could have done it with a tractor.
Huh.
But those horses, back, you know, this way, you know, that way.
Uh-huh.
And then if they got turned a little bit, he'd move them forward, get that wagon straight, not just where it was.
This was
turn
the manure.
Thing around, complete U shape like that.
The manure filler.
Yeah, the manure
I mean, the
wagon.
Manure spreader.
Manure spreader.
Yeah, yeah. I've got a story of a horse that was always running away, and she ran away with the manure spreader.
Oh,
and the tailgate hadn't been put in.
Yeah.
And sprayed manure all the way out the road.
All the way down the road, yeah.
Because he was loading and he hadn't done it yet, and Milton Konecki yelled in from the barn to come and help him with something.
Yeah.
And so he raced in and the horse took off. And of course, immediately the thing began spraying all the way down. Yeah.
Oh, Gene.
Here's a Coe Valley story. Maybe we can use it in our book.
This is a hayload story. We had a team of horses, but we didn't use them a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And on this particular day, we were pulling the hayloader along a hillside.
Mm-hmm.
This is a little tippy, especially as that flatbed wagon got more and more hay on it.
Mm-hmm.
And we made a turn down at the far end, and we're coming back. And I really thought it was too tippy. And so I stopped the tractor. And I yelled back, I says, you know, guys, I don't think we can do this. I think we're going to dump it. No, that's okay, Fred. Russell hollered up. That's okay, Fred. Go ahead. Well, okay. And sure enough, we got to a little steeper place. And Yeah. Fortunately, I think they detected that they were, it was getting a little tippy, those wheels on the high side of the hill were starting to barely touch the ground, you know. And fortunately, they got over on that side of the load. So all at once, of course, here goes the darn thing. The loader fell over, too. You know, the hay loader in the back end. And
I love those hay loaders.
Oh, hey, they were nice. And of course, it didn't bother the tractor any. As soon as I saw a thing going, I just pulled a pin. Mm-hmm. I didn't want the tractor to go, too. Or bust a tongue. Mm-hmm. I was afraid we were going to splinter the tongue. And over it went. Those two guys jumped off the high side. They landed on the wheels.
Oh, dear.
Wagon wheel.
Must have hurt them.
Gosh, yeah. Yeah, I knew I shouldn't have done it. I should have just said, no, we aren't going to do it. But I was just a kid, and they were grown
telling
men,
you
know, and they'd go ahead. But, yeah, I don't think we ought to do this.
Do you remember any accidents at the farm? Any
like that?
Most small or large?
Up at Malloy.
Accidents or injuries?
I don't recall anybody getting injured out there.
I've got a...
Back there's a thing on the back cover that talks about where she is, see? So I just called down here, and since she's teaching at the school, at the college, I got a hold of her right away. And so I was down here for another kind of public health meeting, and I got a hold of her and we got together. So we've been sitting here shooting the breeze about 50 years ago. God, that's a long time, you know that? Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, I was doing that then, and then I became a county public health administrator, and I did several counties in Illinois, and now I finally retired. So I can do anything I want to do. I figured you were about that. I was giving you the benefit of the doubt, though. I said, it's probably about 85. Wadsworth? I haven't seen the Wadsworth for a coon's age. Yeah, I don't know where Cal is. Tom, I think, is still over there and over there by Walkett.
I'm talking to. I've got the tape recorder here. I'm talking to Rush Ulias, and he says that Freddie was a great bull snake catcher.
Yeah.
And he'd keep them for pets. In your room at the.
Back in Moline, I kept them. And my dad had built the glass cases for them.
He built glass cases.
Yeah.
So when you caught them at the farm, what would you do with them?
I'd take them home.
Take them home to Moline?
Yeah, take them home.
On the bus?
At Coal Valley, I could go.
At Coal Valley, you could
go back and forth. Russell would drop me off in town once in a while.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll hang up then. He's sitting here reading my big, big book. He's on to Art Rashke right now. I don't know if he remembers Art Rashke, if Art Rashke was there in 45. Yeah. He was crippled. Oh no, he got killed up at the 4-H fair. He was cow testing a cow or something, and he got crushed up against the side. Yeah. Yeah, quite a long while ago. Well, it's good to talk to you. Tell Ruth I'm glad she finally hung up. I said, tell Ruth I'm glad she finally hung up. Okay. Bye-bye.
He remarried after Liberta died?
Yeah. Married Ruth. Nice woman.
Yeah. Local,
I think she was local.
Lady from Janesville?
I think so, yeah. From the area, anyway.
Wow. Yeah, I forgot about those bull snakes. I was hot. We had this biology teacher in high school who was really into reptiles. You know, he was a big thing in reptiles. And we even went up to Maquoketa Caves, Iowa, there, and hunted and caught timber rattlers.
Uh-huh.
And brought them down to show the kids in the class and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And so a couple other guys in the class and a teacher and I would go out on these forays to find snakes. There were blue racers, pretty common snake around there.
Mm-hmm.
Bull snakes around there, there was a lot of those. We found some hognose snakes and some fox snakes, and different kinds, different species like that. There weren't other than the rattlesnakes, there weren't any other poison ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would get a lot of those. And this one kid, a friend of mine at school, Lloyd Allen, was as fascinated with these animals as I was. And we collected enough reptiles and amphibians that we could put a whole show on.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very popular back in those days for the grade schools to have grade school carnivals.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we would reserve a room in the school. First my own school where I'd been, his own school where he'd been, then we did other schools in the town.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd take our snakes and salamanders and frogs and all that kind of stuff, you know, over to the thing so people could see them.
Mm-hmm.
And as we got more trustworthy, because we were high school kids, he would let us take the rattlesnakes over mm-hmm. to. And my dad decided that, you know, that I'd have a better way to display them than in these wire boxes, you know, wire covered them. So he went and made a whole smear of glass cases, with 9 by 12 window panes. And so it had a wooden bottom, had little feet on it. It had wood on the corners and around the edges.
Mm-hmm.
He was a
nice
good,
job.
He was a cabinet maker.
Mm-hmm.
Besides being a tool designer and all that stuff. And then he made a little glass top, and he fixed it so it was just slightly raised so there was air mm-hmm. going in and out. And so we had, we must have had a dozen or so of those. When he started turning them out, he started turning out a whole bunch.
Mm-hmm.
And the hardest part was finding glass to fit in. But so we take those over to school. We had so many one time, we did two schools in one night. You know, we took half the snakes over to one place and half the snakes to the other place. And that was always a big draw. Mm-hmm. Everybody wanted to come in and see these different snakes.
Mm-hmm.
And we had them labeled about what they were and about how old they were and what they ate and all kinds of stuff like that. They eat mice? Yeah, they eat mice. You know. And at high school, you always had a lot of white mice around.
Mm-hmm.
And they, of course, reproduce there. And so when you get too darn many of them, I throw them in the cage with a snake, you know. They would gobble them up like popcorn.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, we had old Killer the Bull Snake. He's about a 6-footer. He's a nice big one. And he's so adapted to captivity. He just loved it. And so if there were too many young mice, you just take the whole litter, raise up the lid and throw them in, and put the lid back down again. Once he discovered that there were mice running around in his cage, once they discovered there was a snake in there, they would all kind of freeze. They just wouldn't move.
You know, mm-hmm.
just freeze in place, hoping that the snake wouldn't detect them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, they were warm bodies, and the snake finally found them all. And so, generally, when we come back the next morning, well, here was Killer with all these little lumps all the way down, all the way down the full length of him, you know, because he ate every one of them. And he was healthy. He was one healthy snake. And we even traded for a bull constrictor from a carnival one time that came to town. We traded a bull snake for a bull. Yeah, bull.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was a nice snake. It was a darn nice snake. Now the guy said this snake is not well. And of course we're gonna give him a healthy snake. And we did. Well, that was okay. It was a rare snake and we thought we could keep it going for a while anyway. We force-fed it eggs
mm-hmm.
With a basting syringe.
Mm-hmm.
And we got it back to health, pretty good shape. I think it just didn't eat much,
mm-hmm.
you know, or it didn't adapt well to captivity and it wouldn't eat.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't too long after that we were able to actually throw live birds and mice and stuff like that in the cage and mm-hmm. it would eat. He was a dandy. Being a constricting type of snake, when you would hold it a lot of times, holding so people could see him, because he had most beautiful colors. If you tilt him in the light a certain way, you know. He was a beautiful thing. All of a sudden, he'd grab your hand in his mouth, and then coils around your arm. And he'd wrap himself around there, you know. Of course, whenever he bit you in the hand, you wound up with teeth marks all over the place. And you bled a little. Yeah. That was okay, you know, he'd unwind him.
It was all between friends, huh?
Yeah. And it was okay. And the teacher would also, you guys ought to wear gloves when you're doing that, you know. At least he won't bite through the gloves. You know. Well, and, you know, it was okay. We didn't mind. But that was the rarest animal that we ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had, from a biological house, we had, we got enough money together to buy a little baby gator, a little tiny alligator about a foot long.
Mm-hmm.
And we had him for quite a while. And he adapted pretty well, too.
Mm-hmm. I've had one upstairs here for a couple of years until just last, a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
The student that lived here.
Had one.
Lives here. Right. Had him. And my daughter was down 2 weeks ago, and she was rummaging around and looking for something. I forget what she was looking for, but she managed to disrupt the order of things in the refrigerator. And
so there he is. Huh? Aha! All right. So we got some mice here.
We got a couple of hamsters, I think.
Oh, okay. That's what they are, all right, yeah. Sure enough.
From the lab at school.
I see.
So I said, Andy, I said, we got a few of these left. And,
jeez.
So there's been some kidding around about what? That, but one of these days we're going to take...
What, his gator eat those?
Oh yeah.
It would.
Yeah, he loves them.
Mostly, we found out about the snakes, that they wouldn't eat a dead animal. They had to be live.
Well, he likes them. He likes them live, but he's hungry enough, he'll grab it.
I see. And, so he will eat them dead?
Yeah. Yeah, I sort of miss him, but he was getting too big for the aquarium, and he couldn't afford a bigger aquarium. He would have had paid about $600. I mean, by the time Elvis left, he was this long.
That long, yeah. Yeah, they grow.
And so he tried and tried to find a place to hear what just recording all about Aunt Elvis here.
So be it.
I just lost a good story. Where they'd take these animals out to a sand hill, these snakes and things, and they'd go into a groundhog hole, and they'd stay there all winter, and then come spring, the snakes would come out again and be sunning on the hill, and Fred would just go out and pick them up again. So that's the way they spent the winter. They'd hibernate into a groundhog, like they were supposed to, into a groundhog hole. Yeah. That's a wonderful story.
And then the salamanders, because they like water, being down in water, we would throw them in that old dug well, throw them back down there. And then in the spring, we'd come out, and we'd take these net potato sacks, and we'd zip them apart. And then sew them all together into a net that we lower down into the dug well, and with a ropes on. And then we just leave it there for a few days, and then come back, and then pull it all up, and get all your salamanders back in, you know, from that well, because that net would just sink on down to the bottom. So we could get our salamanders back too. It wasn't any problem. And they hibernate through all winter. And that was a lot of fun. But, you know, the development of the Quad City Airport was an important thing. And so most of the wetland that was out there around the edge of the airport was all filled.
Which is too bad, because
lost all the reptiles. Yeah,
that way.
There's no more snakes and stuff like that up there. So. And I haven't seen a bull snake in its natural habitat for 30 years out there.
Gone.
They're gone.
There must be some somewhere though.
Yeah, probably are, but I don't know where.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, you can go back on those same old bluffs and that hill and back on that old farm that's there. I suppose, and if you went often enough and you found the right places, you might get lucky on a sunny day, find some sun of themselves on the hillside.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hope there's still a few.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, they're not all gone. But the biology teacher, he objected strenuously to what the people at the airport were going to do with that wetland, because he spent a lot of time down there. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd go in with his waders, mm-hmm, in that swamp and pick up all different kinds of frogs and stuff like that, spring peepers and all those different reptiles and amphibians, and he'd bring them back and show the kids in the class. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget this story either. He decided one day, he was talking about the balance of nature. It was a lesson we were doing. And he had a sparrow that he caught. And he brought out Killer and set him up on his cage, up on his demonstration table in front of the class, and took out the sparrow out of the box and opened up the door and threw the sparrow in to Killer's cage. And he was talking about the balance of nature and how these animals, you know, that's the way nature works, and mm-hmm, and they eat live things, all sort of stuff. This girl I'm sitting next to, who's the valedictorian of our class, Barbara, we were up on the sort of the top shelf, you know, the chairs were one step up, you know, mm-hmm, so everybody could see down on the table, and she come barreling down there, and down the aisle, ran down to the table, opened up the snake's cage, out flew the bird, ran for the window, threw open the window, and of course, the teacher was sort of nonplussed about the whole thing. Heck, we thought Killer was going to get himself a bird, you know. Killer was sort of our pet snake. And pretty nonplussed about the whole thing. And he said, and we do have this problem where man interferes with the balance of nature on a very regular basis, and we're going to upset the whole apple cart if we keep doing stuff like this. And then he got into the thing about what was happening at the airport, and they were filling all this land, and, you know, there are, you know, thousands and thousands of these frogs and stuff out there, and salamanders in there, and water snakes, and all this kind of stuff, and they were all going to die because of this, you know. So we got a quick lesson in how to protect the environment, mm-hmm, way back then, you know, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he was sort of on top of it. He taught the high school there for several years, and then he taught out east in, I think, Virginia or